The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Have you ever had the desire to trace the steps of a famous explorer, or maybe recreate a trip undertaken years earlier, perhaps by a parent or other family member? On today's Armchair Traveler, writer Sylvie Bigger of New York writes, "My grandfather wrote a Moroccan travelogue in 1920. Almost a century later, I set out to recreate his trip." Now, her article is from the June 2, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. It was October 1920 in Paris, and my grandfather, a young Swiss engineer named Louis Schwab, couldn't contain his excitement. After just a few months on the job, his boss was sending him on a fact-finding mission to build a dam on the Oum el-Rabia, one of Morocco's largest rivers. I was a kid again, ready to embark on a fabulous and scientific Jules Verne adventure, he wrote under the pen name Louis de Ate. Technology, travel, and poetry would remain Schwab's lifelong passions. Some of his poems appeared in technical journals and local newspapers, but after his death, my mother compiled his writings into a book she published as The Engineer's Repose. In the text she used as an introduction, he urged writers to recognize the beauty hiding behind the power of water and even behind the industrial process itself. "Take your lute, O poet," he wrote in the 1950s. "Leave the literary chapels and smoky taverns behind. Seek the higher elevations where energy emerges and the valleys where it blooms." I was in my teens when he died and had been more into my boyfriend than my grandfather. Still, could he have been the inspiration behind my choice of occupation as a travel writer? I had read his poems, but only recently discovered these lines I picked up on the banks of the Oum el-Rabia, his famous or fabulous essay about the 1920 Morocco trip, and literally started packing my bags. Almost a century after he did, I embarked on my own odyssey along the Oum el-Rabia. It wasn't exactly clear where he had gone. My mother had only found the beginning of the essay, but he mentioned the delta and several towns along the way to the source of the Middle Atlas Mountains. I decided to follow the river from the ocean to the source. Oum el-Rabia means Mother of Spring in Arabic. Fittingly, I landed in Casablanca under pouring rain last month. My grandfather rode a rickety train from Casablanca, but on the recommendation of a friend, I enlisted the services of a wiry tour company driver named Hassan Afaf. After an easy 2-hour drive south on the highway, we chose to stay in the only hotel within the 16th century walls of Mazagan, the historic name my grandfather used for the town of El Jadida on the Atlantic Ocean. Now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the fortifications and the town, built by Portuguese explorers, made for a magical playground as children ran up and down the alleyways. The eerie Portuguese cistern, hidden under the town's main thoroughfare, still held rainwater, defying the centuries. The next morning, we drove to nearby Azamour and its ancient Arab quarter suspended on a cliff over the left bank of the Oum el-Rabia. I couldn't wait. As soon as I saw the water, I jumped out of the car and made my way through the reeds and stones. I should say reeds and stones. Then I stood still, watching a lone white heron wander in the ripples. On the other side, palm trees and lush farmland lined the water. I tried to imagine what my grandfather had seen, the sandy estuary about a mile away, the red and green fishermen's boats. I looked down. There were footsteps in the reddish earth. "You want to see Aisha's grave?" Hassan asked. As it turned out, in the 16th century, a beauty named Lela Aisha Bahariya, with tresses so long that they painted landscapes on the sand behind her, according to local folklore, was buried nearby. "Her vain search for her lover brought her here for her death," he said. "Women come here from everywhere to pray to get pregnant or married. I didn't need either, but was intrigued. Near the White Mausoleum, live chickens could be purchased for sacrifices. In a small room covered with inscriptions in Arabic, women of all ages, some veiled, some wearing denim jackets, chatted loudly. I peeked inside, and someone asked if I wanted some magic water, then sprinkled drops onto my head from her bottle. The next morning, we left for Siti Said Mashal, Morocco's oldest dam, which was completed in 1929. There was no way to know for sure whether my grandfather participated in its construction, but it was my best guess that he had. Hassan devised a shortcut, and we soon left the busy road and found ourselves on a dirt path. Mimosa trees in full bloom lined our route, and as far as I could see, rolling meadows sparkled with poppies and purple wildflowers. Led by small boys or men in jalabas, herds of sheep gobbled up the rich grass. In the distance, though, high-voltage power lines reminded us of civilization and the impact of electricity. Standing over the horizon, a gigantic skeleton resembling Don Quixote, the steel pylon rises, or rather raises its tall profile, my grandfather had written. The landscape was getting rockier, and all of a sudden, as if someone had scissored the red cliffs, a red canyon opened up with water flowing at the bottom. I got out of the car and walked the red brick bridge over the Nam. On one side sat a tamed lake, on the other the old Merbia meandered bravely through the rocks, and there, well hidden among the phragmites, was the clear silhouette of another heron. Was I being watched? It took several hours to drive to the town of Beni Mellal, along a stony plateau. There, at sunset, accompanied by the call of the Mezouin, we joined a jolly crowd strolling around the formal gardens that surround the several springs. And to the song of the Mezouin, the night curtains fall slowly on the magical spectacle he had written. We got our first taste of the mighty Middle Atlas mountain range the next day, on our way to the large dam of Bin El Ordain, as we negotiated twists and turns, while whiffs of thyme and mint billowed in the spring breeze, and young children sold fresh herbs by the road. This was not my river, and the construction dated to 1953, but I wanted to see the geographical impact of a massive dam. An anonymous worker laboring with dynamite, I strove to inscribe onto the slopes a poem of stone my grandfather wrote. In the middle of the scrubby mountains, a steel-blue lake appeared, and with it a new world with stunning homes and resorts. This was the resort town of Bin Al Hudain. Vacationers lined up by the rental boats. Rumor had it that the king of Morocco came here to ride a jet ski. After another hour of driving, we crossed into a wintry tundra. Then forests of cedars covered in snow started appearing along the icy road. We were proceeding slowly, and perhaps to remind me I was in Africa, not in my native Switzerland, a group of monkeys appeared in a clearing. Morocco kept surprising me. Meanwhile, as always, people appeared out of nowhere, on foot or riding donkeys, going their own steady pace. As we drove farther down toward the valley, the landscape turned rocky again. We followed the road toward the cliffs until we reached a parking area. Hassan pointed up at the cliffs where the Aum Arabia gushed out of the rocks. "Come to the source," said a young boy, as if he had been waiting for me. Along the path, crouching women tended to flatbreads as they swelled in stone hearths. Others offered me pastries, shiny with honey, but I wasn't interested. I followed the boy. The higher we got, the louder the river, and finally, there it was, the Aum Arabia. Had my grandfather stood here almost 100 years ago? I pointed my phone at it. The screen went blank. "Oh, come on," I yelled. But then I stopped, stricken, remembering that my grandfather had become blind in the last years of his life. I closed my eyes, listened to the roar above, and cried. Next, we returned to the East Coast, more specifically to Delaware, where millions of horseshoe crabs spawn on the shores of Delaware Bay each year. Here's how to see them, as writer David Brown of Baltimore leads our tour. His article from the April 27, 2018 issue of the Washington Post, and there is a correction that begins the article. It says an earlier version of this story stated that the upside-down horseshoe crabs that remain on the beach after the mating ritual are dead. In fact, the crabs are only stranded and may return to the water if they are turned right side up. The story has been updated, as you will hear. The water was high, but not so high that we couldn't get under the Frederica Bridge with anything more than a duck of our heads as the just-turning tide carried our kayaks toward Delaware Bay. It was a spring tide in late spring. We were an armada of 15 boats. We were here to watch what happens when the full moon calls to one of its oldest listeners. Each May and June, millions of Atlantic horseshoe crabs come ashore along the East Coast to spawn. The invasion is most dramatic when there is a full moon or new moon creating the highest tides of the month. When it's over, the beach is littered with the helmet-shaped shells of Limulus polyphemus and trillions of its greenish eggs. While these animals spawn from Maine to the Yucatan Peninsula, Delaware Bay is the center of activity. Exactly why isn't certain, but warm water and sandy shores without big surf are part of the reason. Some swim and crawl more than 60 miles from the continental shelf to the mouth of the bay to get here. We came farther to see them. 30 of us from New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and the district spent 3 days and 2 nights on the Delaware side of the bay on a trip run by Upstream Alliance, an environmental education organization based in Annapolis. It's not a trip you can duplicate exactly, more on that later, but a destination worth getting to nevertheless. The group included numerous people from places upstream of the bay, including a legislator and a staff committee director from the Pennsylvania General Assembly, an official of the Camden County, New Jersey Parks Department, and an executive of Philadelphia's William Penn Foundation. They were curious about the condition of estuary fed by a once notoriously polluted river. Just how polluted did the Delaware River used to be? In 1943, Pennsylvania's governor loudly complained that his state's National Guard had embarked for Europe from New York, not Philadelphia. The reason? The Navy refused to send vessels up the Delaware because of its corrosive effect on hulls. Today, the Delaware River is not what it used to be. What it empties into, Delaware Bay, is no longer the stinky little sister of the Chesapeake Bay, which is 5 times larger and 1 peninsula to the south. It's a gem hidden in plain sight, ready for the invasion. The Murdocule River, roughly Muddy River in Dutch, carried us to the bay through a marsh in the full flush of spring. On one bank, the empty seed heads of wild rice stood above the new growth, while on the other bank, the feathery tops of the reeds fluttered. Where the bank was higher, cedars grew. Red-winged blackbirds flashed their shoulder patches, and a pair of ospreys rubbered necklaces as they glided overhead. Soon we passed through Bowers Beach, population 360, with just enough time to exchange greetings with diners on a restaurant balcony before the current swept us into the Delaware Bay. In the distance, a half dozen container ships were making their way northward to Wilmington and Philadelphia. We came ashore on a beach just to the south to eat lunch. As we finished, a wooden boat appeared out of the distant haze. Don Bow, our leader and the president of Upstream Alliance, identified it as the Maggie S. Myers, built in 1893 in Delaware Bay's last oyster schooner. It was returning from a day of fishing for conch, but with a dirty hull, a furled black sail, and tattooed men stowing gear on deck, it looked like a pirate ship returning from a raid. After a while, we pushed off and headed south. Our leader had secured permission for us to camp on private land a few miles away. There, after setting up tents, collapsible tables, and chairs in the hot sun, a few of us headed to the water for a swim. As we waded in, our feet bumped against, or were bumped by, things hard and rough. Soon it was clear that on the bottom was an invasion force of horseshoe crabs lying in wait. We stumbled into an underwater D-Day. Thank God for water shoes. A bad rap. There was plenty of time to talk in the long evening before the moon's pulling power brought the horseshoe crabs onto the beach. Much of the conversation was about water. The people from Philadelphia noted that while the water quality of the Delaware River and its tributaries had improved greatly, That fact hadn't made it into public consciousness. Swimming in any of the city's waters was illegal, except for organized events such as triathlons. Ball said he had been accosted by police while kayaking and told even that it wasn't permitted. "People are still turning their back on the water," said Maggie McCann Johns, the Camden County Parks official. The bad reputation was understandable. A few decades ago, striped bass and shad wouldn't swim past Wilmington because oxygen levels in the water were too low for survival. In the tributaries of the upper Delaware Bay, fish kills of a million or more menhaden occurred about once a summer. "I can't remember the last time that happened," said Robin Tyler, an aquatic ecologist at the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. After dinner, Tyler, who has since retired, delivered a brief lecture on the history of bay cleanup. He said the Clean Water Act of 1972 and economic change are the big reasons for the difference now. Kent County, the middle of Delaware's three counties, and where we were camping, used to have four city sewage plants and an equal number of cannery and factory outfalls. None of them did a good job cleaning their effluent. Today, there's only one point source discharge in the whole county, a sewage treatment plant outside Milford fed by 500 miles of pipes and 85 pump stations. The water it discharges is cleaner than many of Delaware's streams. "Although we hear a lot about environmental degradation, I would say in the last 25 years things have gotten better out of these waters," Tyler said. The mating dance. By the time the lecture was over, the moon had appeared, a pale disk on the horizon, then a bright orb in full geographic display. We sat around a bonfire until the high tide and then wandered down the beach to see what was happening. We found a strange sight. In groups separated by only a few feet, horseshoe crabs were swimming ashore, milling in the shallows and climbing on each other. The females of the species are larger than the males, and the clusters of crabs often centered on a large individual, presumably a female. We checked a few. You can tell their sex easily by examining their forelegs, but in general didn't disturb the foreplay. Males can hold on to a female and ride her to the egg-laying site on the beach. A few had succeeded in this. Some females, however, were heading back to deeper water to shake their dates. Others were leading suitors into a conga line. Round, backed, and shiny, they look like giant ticks, to which they are distantly related. Randomness and confusion was the order of the hour. It seemed an odd behavior for an animal that had for millions of years to perfect its mating dance. Alas, what they had to look forward to was underwhelming. There's no actual copulation. Instead, horseshoe crab mating is glorified onanism. The female digs a small depression in the sand, deposits about 200 eggs, and the male on her back releases sperm onto them. The satellite males trailing behind then get their chance. In horseshoe crab society, the also-rans get a chance to procreate, too. This mating ritual goes on several times a night. We watched by moonlight and flashlight, took pictures, and made a lot of off-color jokes. Someone said it was too bad we'd all be asleep when the crabs lay back on the beach at 3 a.m. and smoked cigarettes. The next morning, I climbed out of the tent and took a walk. The sand was pockmarked with depressions and the marks of scrabbling appendages and digging tails. The shoreline was like a low-rent motel with an unmade bed in each room. Housekeeping, the rising tide, wouldn't be there for hours. Stranded on the beach. Horseshoe crabs are said to be living fossils, but that's not quite true. They're related to trilobites, which lived 550 million years ago and have existed as a distinct species for at least 450 million years. But they're not unchanged. A fossil found in England from the Silurian period 425 million years ago revealed an animal with more legs than its modern descendants. The animal's utility to human beings has also evolved. From the 1870s through the 1930s, up to 5 million horseshoe crabs a year were collected and ground up for fertilizer and animal feed. That practice ended in the 1960s, but in the 1980s a new harvest began as they were caught for bait for eel and conch traps. In the 1990s, scientists noted a decline in the numbers of red knots, a migratory bird dependent on refueling on Delaware Bay's horseshoe crab eggs on its flight from South America to the Arctic. These days, about 45,000 red knots stop. They can double their weight in 2 weeks. reasoning that over-harvesting might be responsible, the federal government created a reserve off the mouth of Delaware Bay where horseshoe crab harvesting is prohibited. That was followed in the early 2000s with a shortening of the season and then a two-year moratorium. At the moment, the Atlantic Coast quota for horseshoe crabs is about 1.6 million animals. Only males can be taken. The Delaware Bay quota is 500,000. How much of the population is that? It's hard to know. But a mark and recapture project in 2003 estimated that there were 20 million spawning crabs in the bay that May. A whole new use for them emerged in the 1970s when the Food and Drug Administration licensed a medical test that employed horseshoe crab blood as its main component. The blood coagulates on contact with endotoxin, a biochemical component of certain bacteria, including many that cause disease. The blood-based test is used to detect contamination in injectable drugs and on surgical implants. People who get hip replacements can include horseshoe crabs on the list of beings to thank. Coast-wide, about 600,000 horseshoe crabs are captured, scrubbed, and bled each year. About a quarter of the animal's blood is collected. The procedure kills about 15% of them, and there may be sublethal impacts like failed spawning, said Stuart Michaels of Delaware's Division of Fish and Wildlife. Spawning appeared to have its own mortality, judging from the beaches we paddled past the next day. Many horseshoe crabs were lying upside down, their stiletto tails, called telsons, standing vertical. I learned later that they are not dead, just stranded and folded in a position that protects their gills. Turning them over or carrying them to the water, not by their tails, may save them. Nevertheless, from a distance, they brought to mind battlefield graves marked by a gun stuck on its bayonet. A question of access. As we headed south on the bay's western shore, we passed Big Stone Beach. It was one of the few fire control towers from World War II remaining on the Delaware shore. Their purpose was to help direct artillery fire on enemy ships. Caught at the right angle, this one looked like an upright three-toothed jawbone. Soon after, we headed offshore to get around a jetty built on the mouth of the Mespillion River to protect a prime spawning beach behind it. A pair of dolphins passed us also heading south. We spent the night on a sliver of private property inside Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge, another stretch of beach available only to people with connections. As we wandered down to the water near midnight, the horseshoe crabs were out in full force again. But there was less pursuit and little mounting, and in truth, they looked a bit tired. We headed back north the next morning. As we tucked into Mespillion River to go to the takeout, we came upon a muddy delta with hundreds of horseshoe crabs mating in broad daylight. They clunked and rumbled against the hulls of the boats. Modesty, it seems, wasn't key to surviving 450 million years. I'm not worried about their future. 50% of Delaware Bay's shore and 25% of New Jersey's had been judged optimal or suitable for spawning in 2010, an amount unchanged since 2002. Hurricane Sandy, however, did considerable damage to the New Jersey side in 2012, reducing habitat suitability by 30%. What's problematic is public access to the Delaware Bay shore. While significant stretches are publicly owned, there's no place for people to have primitive camp experiences as we did without making special arrangements. The horseshoe crabs can come ashore for a good time. Why not the bipedal primates? And if you're considering a visit to the Delaware Bay, here are some if-you-go tips that accompany David Brown's article. Although much of the shoreline of the Delaware side of Delaware Bay is owned or managed by state and county governments, there are no sites for primitive camping. Places to launch kayaks can be found at the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control website. That's DNREC.Delaware.gov. That's DNREC.Delaware.gov. And you can search under tidal water fishing and boating access areas. Maps of natural areas are at the website under wildlife area maps and regulations. The DuPont Nature Center at the mouth of the Mespillion River is open May through August, Tuesday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Well, if you head south of the Delaware Bay, there we go, you will eventually reach the coastal community of Beaufort, North Carolina. Well, writer Martha Quillen recently highlighted the town's Pirate Festival and how the local Blackbeard exhibit is expanding in an article published in the June 7th, 2018 News and Observer. As pirates take over Beaufort this week, Town's Blackbeard exhibit is expanding. Blackbeard, feared and loathed during his short piratical career, is celebrated in these more modern times. Nowhere is that more evident than at the North Carolina Maritime Museum on the Beaufort waterfront, which marks the 300th anniversary of the grounding of the Queen Anne's Revenge this past weekend, which was June 9th and 10th, with an expanded exhibit including never-seen-before artifacts from the shipwreck, a new highway marker, and a day-long symposium on the pirate's life. The events mark the kickoff of Pirate Week at the museum, celebrated with a themed take-home of crafts and viewings of the film Blackbeard's Lost Ship, or Last Ship. The commemorations begin at 1 p.m. Thursday, when the state will unveil a new highway marker noting Blackbeard's connection to North Carolina, and that was done on June 7th. The marker placed on the drive leading to Fort Macon at Atlantic Beach. The expanded exhibit opened on Friday and Saturday of that weekend. It was Maritime Day, when visitors got to sail in the Maritime's fleet of traditional wooden boats and cast a line with a cane pole. Maritime Day events, which were free and open to the public, were based at the museum's extension on Gallant's Channel. That's at 172 West Beaufort Road. The Maritime Museum has been home since 2011 to the Who Was Blackbeard exhibit, the largest display of artifacts from the Queen Anne's Revenge. On Friday, the museum opened an 800-square-foot expansion to the attraction. The Queen Anne's Revenge, Blackbeard's flagship, ran aground in 1718 and was found in 1996 in about 20 feet of water off the North Carolina coast. Salvagers have removed and documented hundreds of artifacts from the ship, more than 300 of which are on display at the state-run museum. After it ran aground, the crew had time to remove most of the valuables the ship held. But what remained is rich in the history of weaponry, wooden ship construction, and 18th century maritime life. The exhibit expansion tells more about what's known of the world and times in which Blackbeard lived. David Cartier, spokesman for the museum, said part of what's new will be a recreation of the Great Cabin from Queen Anne's Revenge, where a combination of artifacts, replicas, props, and technology will be used to show us accurately as possible Blackbeard's room aboard the ship. An image of the infamous pirate will be projected into the exhibit to make it appear he's in the room. The museum also is adding information about another of Blackbeard's ships that ran aground at the same time as the Queen Anne's Revenge. Remains of that ill-fated vessel, the Adventure, have yet to be found. In this part of the exhibit, Cartier said, the museum is adding a fly-through virtual tour of the interior and exterior of the Queen Anne's Revenge. There are significant new artifacts from the ship, the first dead eye to be conserved from the wreckage. These were used to tension the shroud supporting the mast. A cast iron cautery iron used by early doctors to close wounds. This one may have come from the town of Charleston, which Blackbeard held for ransom in March 1718. A pair of hammerheads used by shipwrights to build items and make repairs. Links from an iron chain used in land surveying. And a brass filigree mallet, cock, and gear from a man's pocket watch dating to between 1660 and 1675. Now, that's Saturday for Maritime Weekend. The museum held the Parade of Cannons, an homage to Blackbeard, with a fleet of boats making its way from the Maritime Museum at the modern-day entrance to Beaufort Harbor to the end of Fulford Street on the site of the White House that marked the harbor's entrance on maps during Blackbeard's day. So there you go. Lots of fun down at Beaufort, and that museum's open, and you can enjoy it year-round, so give it a trip. Well, that's it for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed your journey. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.